I would like to read something out of the pastor manual that the church provides us, at least the opening sentences of it. And that goes as follows. The church pastor is an appointed position in the United Church of God, AIA. A church pastor must be an elder in good standing as defined by the Ministerial Code of Ethics, the Constitution and Bylaws, and all other policies outlined by the Council of Elders. A church pastor must serve his people, provide guidance and assistance to members, and be aware of their needs and wants every minute of every day. He should spend most of his time with the elderly in the congregation, yet spend 70% of his time with the youth. He must attend all activities, potluck meals, fundraisers, roofing projects, deacons' meetings, the GCE, youth camps, youth tournaments, youth Bible classes, midweek Bible studies, maintain feast responsibilities, and visit everybody in their homes at least 3 times a year. Plus, be good at sports, be good at grilling steaks, be good at board games, be good at bingo, be a card shark, drive 50,000 miles a year, be active on Facebook, have an impeccable home, be an active member of the Moose Lodge, have cable television, have funny jokes, hunt deer, and break dance. Let's see. None. Anyway, he is always fair in arbitration and people assessments. And in a debated conflict with another member, he calls it as he sees it. Yet he will always agree with me. He must be present at every hospital visit of every church member. He must give compelling, gripping messages at church that are no longer than 10 minutes. He drives either a Jaguar, Porsche, or a Corvette and lets the youth park it for him when he arrives at church. Ideally, he should be a martial arts expert, be good with knives, and not have any gray hair, but at least have 40 years of pastoral experience and be 35 years of age. The pastor must be all things to all people. Well, let nobody kid you. Being a pastor is a piece of cake. So why do I read all these expectations? And actually, there's a little more truth involved than might first meet the ear or eye when, from what I just read. Why would I discuss such expectations? Because sooner than you realize, it will be your turn to pastor a congregation. Or two, or three, or four, thanks, or more. And hopefully your future congregations will be easier to manage than some that are mentioned in the Bible, like Corinth or Laodicea. Maybe they would be more like Philippi. Now, a question I might toss out here. If you were given a Corinth to handle in sufficient time, could you turn it, transform it into the Church of Philippi? You know, eventually we were going to be taking care of many, many more people in future church congregations in the millennium. We need to prepare now to successfully pastor our future congregations. Now, does it say, thou shalt pastor future congregations in the millennium? Not in those words, but let's look at the words that we do have to go by and realize that that would be the conclusion. Over in Luke chapter 19, it's a parable to the Matthew 25 account of the parable of the talents. Over in Luke chapter 19, the terminology as far as rewarding is expressed in the term cities. In Luke chapter 19, verse 15, and it came to pass that when Christ was returned, having received the kingdom, then he commanded these servants to whom he had given the money that he might know how much everybody had gained by trading. And the first came, saying, Lord, your pound has gained 10 pounds. And he said to him, well done, good and faithful servant. Because you have been faithful in that which was little, you will have authority over 10 cities. And the second came and saying, well, your pound has gained 5 pounds. And his response was, verse 19, be you also the ruler over 5 cities. Having that in mind, now let's go over to Revelation 2. Revelation chapter 2 and verse 26. Revelation 2 and verse 26. think these are familiar scriptures to many. Chapter 2, verse 26. And he that overcomes and keeps my works unto the end, to him I will give power over the nations. And then chapter 3 of Revelation in verse 21, we see, to him that overcomes will I grant to sit with me on my throne, to sit and reign with Christ, even as I also overcame and have sat down with my Father in his throne. And while we're in the book of Revelation, we might as well go to chapter 5. Chapter 5 and verse 10, where we also read, this is reference to the saints, and has made us unto our gods kings and priests, and we shall reign on the earth. We will have priestly responsibility. Now that's ministerial. And if you're involved with the ministry, you're involved with people. It is constant activity with people. So we can see that we have large responsibilities. If we are able to endure to the end and are loyal with God, he will give us additional work to do. In the beginning, I can see that when Christ returns, there'll be a time eventually for some celebration and rejoicing. The fact that we're now at the transitioning into the millennium, 1,000 years of peace. But it's going to be 1,000 years of hard work. And we will be blessed to be resurrected and transformed. We won't have physical bodies that get tired, that need to get to the hospital once in a while. We'll be bionic. We'll have boundless energy. But work will still be work. And our work will be with people. And I will think by then, if not before, we will be motivated out of love to want to help humanity. And God is going to give his saints increased responsibility supervising people. The population will start to expand. And the knowledge of the eternal will be as the waters that cover the ocean. It'll be universal. So with all of that in mind, we'll be working with a lot of people. What we've covered at the feast, Isaiah 30, verse 20, it says, you know, there'll be a voice that comes behind different people saying, this is the way, walk you in it. That will be us. We'll be looking out for the welfare of others and teaching people. It'll be an exciting time. It'll be a time of productivity. And it'll go on for 1,000 years. A lot of worthwhile work. There's nothing more significant in life than spiritually nurturing other human beings. It's a huge responsibility. It's a sobering responsibility, but it is one that is very rewarding, gratifying, and one that is so necessary. And the run of that main sector of that responsibility goes to the brethren that have learned to live this way of life and now have a greater chance than ever to share it. A lot of times people talk about, well, I just look forward to making it into the kingdom. You know, enduring to the end. Well, there's a lot of truth in that, but that's not the end. It's where we get to the beginning of the beginning. With the rest of eternity, we'll be expanding our roles as responsible teachers, and we'll be working with lots of people. And God, being the God that he is, says, let everything be done in order. He is an orderly, logical God, and he plans. And so people will be in groups, there'll be accountability, and we'll have a lot of people to be steering in the direction of God. And most likely it'll be done in groups, congregations. So you and I will have, especially all of you, will have a chance to work with people more directly than ever before. And you'll have congregations and people that you'll be responsible for. So it's a lot of work, but exhilarating, gratifying. Now, it might not seem that hard, right? Satan will be bound for 1,000 years. But maybe we'll find out just how powerful and persuasive human nature can be. Because human nature will still be with us. And what do we know about human nature? It opposes God. I used to think, before I came into God to understand what I know now, I thought that human nature was inherently good. I didn't understand Romans 8, 7 or Jeremiah 17, 9. It says that the carnal mind is enmity against God. In Romans it says that. And Jeremiah is very unflattering when he described under inspiration of God that the heart it can be deceitfully wicked. We can deceive ourselves. We can think we're great when we are deficient. We can kid ourselves, deceive ourselves. And we come to understand that no, with God's Spirit, we can see things they really are the way they are. We know that we have to fight against these different poles now, and the people that we work with are not always going to make the right decisions. They're not going to be perfect people. If they were, then we'd be working for them. So we know from the New Testament that it is possible for congregations to spiritually thrive. Such was the congregation at the town of Philippi. And so Paul wrote very lovingly and in exemplary or laudatory terms about the brethren at Philippi. And for Philippi, for Smyrna, and Philadelphia, there was no real correction, but still the willingness to guide those people to even greater success. I can think of modern-day congregations that, to me, have been legendary as far as brethren that have sacrificed for the work. I think of brethren in Pasadena in years gone by and other places. There are some congregations that have successfully stood the test of time. And then some that maybe were not on the best of foundations that went through some shakedown. The key as far as having success in local congregations revolves around, and this is no surprise to any of us, unification in doctrine, everybody believing and teaching the same thing, having the same goal, having the goal of the kingdom of God, for example, or having a goal of doing a work, preparing a people, which is a motto of the church, having love for each other, agape love, and that comes from God, comes from answered prayer. Working together, not against each other. Again, getting back to unity, where the church is fitly framed together, that this congregation be fitly framed together, that the people that you will be working with in the future will be fitly framed together. And that's the consistency in God's mind. In Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 3, we can see where Paul talks a great deal about this, and maybe it's best encapsulated here in the fourth chapter of Ephesians. Ephesians chapter 3. Well, let's start in the first verse. That's all quite valuable. I therefore, the prisoner of the Lord, that's Paul speaking, beseech you that you walk worthy of the vocation wherewith you are called, with all lowliness of mind, and long suffering, and forbearing one another in love. Paul was not a capricious person. He didn't just shoot from the hip, not the John Wayne syndrome. You got a bad attitude. Boom. No, he was just more careful than that. He believed in being kind, easy to entreat, being in love with the brethren. Verse 3, endeavoring, among everything else, to keep the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. There is one body, one Spirit, even as you are now called in one hope of your calling, one Lord, one faith, and one baptism. I can remember the analogy that Mr. Kubik gave back at the Indianapolis conference when he was talking about the success that the church needed to have back then. He said that there's a, I guess it was from Russia, a proverb or a concept that you could take a piece of straw and you could, or a small twig that was flimsy, and you could easily snap it over your leg, over your knee. It would break. But if you took 1,000 of them and bundled them up and then tried to break them, there would be a great resistance. They would be so much stronger. When you have everyone in unity, all working in the same way, on the same wavelength, you have a powerful unity that is hard to penetrate, at least for anybody that would try to create dissension or opposition. The Apostle Paul faced a major challenge when he came to the church at Corinth. And Corinth had become very divided. It was not like Philippi. It wasn't like Philadelphia and some of the other congregations, maybe even Antioch at the time. But let's go over to 1 Corinthians chapter 3 in verse 9. 1 Corinthians chapter 3 and verse 9. There were so many things that the brethren in Corinth were doing incorrectly. They did have some other activity in their favor, but they were in danger of major implosion. In 1 Corinthians chapter 3, Paul ended up addressing this head on in verse 9. Here he says, "We are laborers together with God. You are God's husbandry. You are God's building. According to the grace of God, which is given unto me, as a wise master builder, I have laid the foundation, and another builds on it, and let every man take heed how he builds thereon. For other foundation can no man lay than is laid, which is Jesus Christ." So any foundation for any church would need to have the doctrines that Jesus Christ had inspired to be placed in the Bible, that would be by his wavelength and his Holy Spirit. Verse 12, "Now if any man build upon this foundation, gold, silver, precious stones, wood, hay, and stubble, every man's works will be made manifest, for the day shall declare it, because it shall be revealed by fire, and the fire shall try every man's works of what sort it is. If any man's works abide, which he has built thereon, he shall receive a reward. And if any man's works shall be burned, he shall suffer loss by fire." Now, that may sound theoretical, but there's nothing theoretical when you see something like that play out. In Corinth and in the different congregations that the Apostle Paul worked with, there were people that had character of gold and silver. They could go through trials, and they were unrattled. They were consistent. They were solid. They kept, they maintained their composure spiritually. There were other people whose foundations were built out of combustible material, hay and stubble, that could just burn up very quickly. And sometimes fiery trials, even ones that are very small in nature, could ignite sparks that could burn up straw and rubble and hay. And that's as far as some people's character could be. And so they would, in that time, their strength would be very small. Paul was understandably concerned in Corinth because of the problems they had that indicated they had no real relationship with God. There were people getting drunk on Passover night. There were people that were territorial and supporting divisions. "I'm of Apollos." And somebody would say, "Well, I'm of Peter." And then somebody else, "Well, I follow Paul. He's the one." And they made almost a deity out of human beings. And then somebody said, "Well, I only follow Christ. I don't follow men." There were people living in adultery. There were others suing each other. Others hung up on paganism and idolatry. And then some that apparently had some ability speaking in tongues did not edify anybody, and were self-righteous over that. And there were church, you could see the fault lines. If you read through the book, you could see where it was ready to break into multiple pieces. It was a disaster waiting to happen. I don't know if we would, well, anyway, that was something that Paul was fighting against. And he wrote at least three, maybe more letters to try to plead with people, to appeal to their conversion and try to get them to turn things around. And it's recorded for our examples so that we can learn from that and learn how he did it. And I'm very impressed when you read some of the things that we'll look at in a minute about how Paul was able to win people over. Now, we may not have the same type of conflicts, but then if you think about it, over the years, many conflicts that you read about in a book like Corinth have reappeared in our time today. In the future, we will probably encounter people with unusual ideas that they'll need to shed so that they can be part of God's church. And they will need to be lovingly guided and carefully and cautiously helped along to finally see what needs to be done, how things need to be changing. And so you will have those people. You'll have people that will come to you and they'll maybe have different unusual ideas and questions. I've used the example of the man that was a mercenary fighter in Southeast Asia for 30 years, and when he came into the visit a minister, he first question he asked was, is it okay to blow up bridges on the Sabbath? Because that was from his point of view. Well, maybe in the millennium you'll encounter some things, and then you'll maybe find me or maybe Mr. Zimmerman, and you say, man, I need to talk to you. I love all the people that I have. It's a wonderful group. I just love the sheep, and I have the chance to shepherd them, and it's a wonderful honor. But I got these two guys in one of my congregations. They don't know any doctrine at all, and they want to speak. And Mr. Willoughby, he gets excited about every doctrinal rumor, and he never studies the literature. He doesn't know any of the Ten Commandments. And I'm not sure what the next move is here. Or somebody, we had a widow, she restored her a 67 Mustang convertible, and she brought it to the church parking lot, and somebody dented it and won't pay for the damages. What do I do? Every time I visit a distant congregation, local attendance falls way off, and people sit at home. We were going to have this 50 sock hop at so-and-so's farm, inside their huge barn, but now that he learned that somebody else is in charge of it, he says, we can't use the barn. He says he's placing my entire congregation on probation, and if we straighten out, we can have the barn next year. This other woman, she says that her pet cobra is not allowed to go to the feast, then she's not going. She says she has a safe cage that she can locate, that she can take it in. So is this really part of my job description? And I might say, well, yeah, it is. No. Well, maybe those are extreme situations that have never come up before. But it's hard to know and anticipate what might. And we may have to make judgment calls. I could say, well, those are your challenges now. Well, everybody, ministers alike, will all have responsibilities. It goes on forever. And probably the majority will not have unusual, extreme questions. But they'll all have needs. They'll all need guidance. They all will need love. And they will need your inspiration, your guidance, to enable them to be successful. And that'll be the whole goal, is to transform these people so that one day they can be born into the God family. That's huge. There's no higher responsibility, no greater job that you could end up with than to do that. And with God's Spirit, all things are possible. I'll quote Luke 1, verse 37, and Matthew 19, verse 26, which says the same thing. With God, all things are possible. And if there's one thing that we will want to see as possible, it will be to help transform the people that are entrusted in our care to becoming full-fledged spirit beings one day. And throughout this whole experience, let me remind ourselves that people are people are people. They're not perfect. They have needs. They can do wonderful things. They may have human nature overcome them on occasion. And the typical thing that we have to do is to remember to have patience, 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 patience. Did I say patience? Absolutely. In your position, when you're caring for people and you're aware of their activities all the time, not just at church, but working with them during the week, and remember, you're never going to need to sleep or be tired if you're a spirit. You can be fasting all the time. And you'll be well aware of the activities of your people. You can't take away their choice. They have to have freedom of choice so that they will develop character. But you will see people at their best and sometimes at their worst. And you may have to step back and think, let me consider there's an overall demeanor, and I need to address that. Christ worked with his 12 disciples. He prayed all night for those disciples. Out of the 100 or so that he was initially working with, he had to have the right team put together to accomplish his 3.5 ministry and have their assistance and use the opportunity to train them. Those were 12 very carnal people. But Christ never forgot their potential. There were times when those disciples did some pretty incredible things. They argued even just a short time before Christ's crucifixion, who's going to be the greatest? Who's going to sit at the right hand of God? Well, I think it should be my family. One mother said of two of the disciples, no, that's not fair. It should be us. And so they're arguing about all of that. And of course, it would do no one any good at all if those wishes were granted. At different times, the disciples were very much at home. They were very much at ease around Christ, which says something also about his leadership style, that he allowed that. That they did have some freedom of expression, but they didn't always use it right. A couple of them said, "Lord, that town rejected us. Should we call down fire on them?" "Yeah, let's do it. Let's settle a few things." "No, you don't know what you ask," he said. And at one point in Matthew 16, Peter actually rebuked Christ. "Oh, we don't like what you're saying. Be it far from you, Lord, to do this thing or to die." And he didn't understand the plan of salvation at all. And so some of the times these disciples looked rather foolish. And Christ saw them at their worst. He saw them at their best. He saw their potential. He never gave up on them. He saw Peter for what he could be, a very powerful leader, and the other disciples as wonderful representatives of the gospel message that were able to make a difference in the communities and the countries that they were sent to. Well, Paul was very corrective at times with the Corinthian church. I've mentioned that they almost imploded there. But let's turn, while we're in Corinthians, let's go to chapter 1 and verse 4. And notice what he did say is he kept his picture, his mind on the overall picture of where he wanted that congregation to go. And yes, they were doing many things wrong. But notice this. In the middle of all these problems, Paul said, chapter 1, verse 4, "I thank my God always on your behalf for the grace of God which is given to you by Jesus Christ." He's saying, "Brethren, I am so thankful that God got your attention to bring you into the church. That's so important to me. I respect you for that. I thank you for being here." In verse 10, he said, he says, "Now I beseech you, brethren," same chapter, verse 10, "Brethren, by the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that you speak the same thing, that there be no divisions among you, that you be perfectly joined together of the same mind and of the same judgment." He's basically saying in different words, "I believe you can do it. I appeal to your good logic." In verse 14, he says, "I thank God that I baptize none of you but Crispus and Gaius." He's saying here, "I don't want to play favorites here. I don't want to be biased. I don't support one person over another. I'm for everybody." In chapter 3, in verse 16, says, "Know you not that you are the temple of God, and the Spirit of God dwells in you?" He also repeats that in chapter 6 and verse 19. He says, he doesn't deride or belittle them. Other people might be tempted to do that, but he says, "No, you're the temple of God. You're housing God's Spirit. You're precious." In chapter 10, verse 24, he again appeals to their well-being. He says, "Let no man seek every one his own, but each man another's wealth." Having mind on others, the welfare of other people. And then, after going through some difficult correction with the Passover, the way they were not keeping it versus how they should have been keeping it, and the misuse of certain gifts, then he gets to chapter 13, which is sometimes referred to as the love chapter, and he talks about the need to pursue faith and hope and love for each other. He says, "I could speak 1,000 words in an unknown tongue. I could I could do miracles and do all kinds of things. But if I don't have the love, it doesn't matter. There's not that agape love for other people. And so he says that that's the way it should be. That's the way he should be to them and them to each other. And then he says in chapter 15, let us not forget the hope of the resurrection, where we're going, and how many things are so much more significant than maybe other issues that have bogged us down. It would have been easy to say, you guys are in a wrong attitude, and this is just horrible what's happening here, and there's too much strife, and so forth. He does somewhat address that, but he tries to maintain a positive outlook, positive expectations, hoping and steering for the best, trying to encourage people. It's like taking a deck of cards or getting a hand in a card game. And maybe you think, well, I wish I had aces and kings and queens, but I've got these other cards. I'm going to transform what I have into something that is quite significant. And in chapter 16 of 1 Corinthians, in verse 13, he talks about the need to watch and stand fast in the faith and be strong. And then he ends that chapter with, I am so thankful for valuable servants in our midst. And then he goes into 2 Corinthians chapter 1. I'll just quickly refer to these. There he says, let us thank God who can enable us to solve all problems. In chapter 2, he talks about being ready to forgive. Chapter 3, the value of God strengthening us. In 2 Corinthians chapter 5, he again talks about our sins are forgiven. We have hope in Christ. And in chapter 7, he says, you brethren are so dear to us in the ministry. And by the time you get to chapter 11, he says, I'm a jealous God over you. You are like a pure virgin that I've promised to God in marriage. So he was totally absorbed with his people. And if they stumbled, it wasn't because he didn't care or he wasn't working with them or writing letters of encouragement or trying to help them. But that was his family. I think of the Kennedy clan in American history, and the patriarch was Joe Kennedy. And he made mention of not just his son that became president, but to all nine of the kids. He said, my business is my family, and my family is my business. And a pastor must care, and that's his business. And you will be in a position where it will be your business. And you will care and ask God for the love and the help, and people will know that you care, and it will make a difference. When you take an interest in a child, that child takes an interest in himself. When you take an interest in other human beings, it's the same thing. The goal is to redeem everybody, inspire everybody to want to live a godly life and to live for eternity. People are not to be viewed as an interruption of our lives. They are the reason we are here. And that'll be one of your mottos when you have the responsibilities. And who else would there be to do it? It's one of the reasons why God is working and building a team of people now. Because we've seen in Revelation 5 and verse 10, somebody has to fill those slots and be the kings and the priests and the leaders. It'll be important that our congregations of the future will be built on strong foundations. Matthew chapter 7 speaks to that. Matthew chapter 7, verse 24 through 26. We can't maybe appreciate that as much as when we compare a structure on a solid foundation to a structure that would be on a very weak foundation. Matthew chapter 7, verse 24. And we see, therefore, whosoever hears these things of mine and does them, says Christ, I will liken him unto a wise man who builds his house on a rock. People that learn the wisdom of God, that try to bring forth good fruit, that walk through the narrow gate, as it says in the previous verses of this chapter. He says, if that person will do that and put God first, be on God's wavelength, he says, I will liken unto him as a wise man that builds his house on a rock. And the rain came, descended, and the floods came, and the winds blew and beat upon that house, and it did not fall, for it was founded on a rock. Makes me, or reminds me of the auditorium in Pasadena, California. Some people said that that auditorium at Ambassador College was the safest building anywhere in the state. It was in an earthquake zone, and when it was constructed, they had these massive pillars that went down below the ground to bedrock. And so the thinking behind it was that if there was a jiggling and a shaking of the earth at that location, that there would be minimal damage because the building would be firmly anchored on all four sides. And so that would restrict the amount of maneuverability that it would have to suffer. So it was as strong a foundation as one could make it. And indeed, it was one of the safest buildings there was. If we continue to read of structure here in Matthew 7 that was not built on a rock, but on sand, it says, verse 26, "And everyone that hears these sayings of mine does not do them shall be likened unto the foolish man which built his house upon the sand." And that would be absolutely insane. I remember a beach party we had one time in the church, and we put the poles deep into the sand to hold the net. And within a couple of hours, they were crooked. They were all askew. We had to reset this thing because of the shifting sand and the water in the sand. So, verse 27, "With adverse weather, the rain descended, the floods came, the winds blew and beat upon that house, and it fell, and great was the fall of it." And that's what happens when you don't have a good spiritual foundation. You can contrast the Ambassador Auditorium to the Leaning Tower of Pisa. I'd like to take a minute or two to describe that, because it was an absolute nightmare from an engineering point of view, the Tower of Pisa. You can go to see it today. The reason why it's still standing was enough people wanted to protect the tourist trade in the town, and some people argued, what would be Italy without the Leaning Tower? So, for a number of reasons, people tolerated it. It was built in 1173 AD, almost 200 feet tall, and it should have gone down to bedrock. It should have gone down, it would have had to have gone down 100 feet below the surface in order to be a solid building. The word Pisa means marsh. And that whole area was sand and marsh. And it was a nightmare, terrible, terrible place to build something like that. And so when they only built it up to three stories, it was already leaning. And so then they decide, we'll compensate. We'll make the columns higher on the side that seems weak so that we can steady it. So eventually it'll go this way and then up. When they got up to level 5, it was already leaning again. So then they put longer columns on the right side than the left, so hoping that it would go like this. And when they got all 8 floors done, it was at a crooked angle. And it stayed that way and just kept inching out over the decades. And finally, 800 years later, one engineer, John Burland from England, was called in, and he realized that the water table was shifting underneath it and was creating havoc. And so they decided to stabilize it. Well, the first attempt was back in 1935, and people were drilling holes into it, and then they were going to fill them with a cement mixture and grout. And after they were done, it went even further. So by the 1990s, they shut it down. And, I mean, no tourists could go in there. And then they stacked 600 tons on one side to keep it steady, and it still leaned. And then they got another 300 tons of mass to put behind it, and then it was still listing. So they decided that they would freeze the ground all around and then add and try to stabilize it with ropes or cables. On the night of September the 7th, though, the tower lurched southward by more than it had done the entire previous year, in spite of all of that. And that's because they had frozen the ground, and then water freezes when it expands, and that loosened the thing, and they thought they were going to lose it. The tower was gone. They had spent $18 million from the Middle Ages on this thing. And some people were already griping, saying, look, it's easier to tear this down. Let's build it anew. It's going to cost a whole lot less. But instead, they kept putting more and more cables into it. And then finally somebody said, well, if it's leaning like this, we will start, instead of adding a lot of mass weight on the foundation, let's start digging out here and see if we can't make it come back to vertical. And so it came back enough, and that town says, hold it at an angle because the tourists won't come. And so it's sitting where it's supposed to, and they say it should be good for another 300 years. But that cost, this last round of expense, was $25 million. That's $43 million. They could have leveled that thing and built 10 of them and just drilled down to bedrock, and they would never have had these crazy problems. But they did not do that. The foundation should have been 100 feet deep. It was only 10 feet deep. And for all the tonnage that it weighed, that was nothing. So it was a nightmare waiting to become a total catastrophe. Would you want your foundation in the millennium for your congregations to look like the Tower of Pisa or Ambassador Auditorium? I don't think we have to spend a whole lot of time mulling that one over. But we realize that we can't build on a loose foundation. The church at Corinth was kind of loosey-goosey, you could say, with beliefs that leaned to the far left, far right, and in every other direction. And some people were being caught up with every wind of doctrine. Some people were thinking, well, we don't need authority. Or we don't need the Apostle Paul as our guide. But they needed help. They needed something. It's not known exactly how the church at Corinth came out. Maybe it was redeemed. But people can get hung up on crazy things. 60 years ago, there were people who were hung up on the fact that the church should have classified bananas as a vegetable instead of a fruit. Now, I don't think that was a real reason that they went off to do their own thing. But it's amazing how you'll have a few mavericks that'll drift off. Sheep will sometimes do that. They'll wander into other pastures where there are loco weeds, and they can feast on other things. I can recall one congregation that I was connected to when I first was living on my own. It was out west, and it wasn't like Corinth, but there was some values were not suggested that people were on shaky ground, on a shaky foundation. I remember when one person came to the minister once, and he wanted to give this offering, and he wanted to do it in haste. And he said, don't ask me where this came from. I can remember turf wars, because one person wanted the information table, and that was his God, and he didn't want anybody to be in charge of it. And somebody else got territorial over who is allowed to lead the songs and so forth. Just strange aspiration. That's not your typical experience. But it's important when you have unity, those things are minimized. When you can have all of your people going in the direction of God, you don't encounter that. It's important, though, whenever we see people that may make mistakes, that we strive to not lose the people that we will be entrusted to care for. We don't want to lose them in the process. I'll never forget when somebody came in as a guest speaker and singled out a couple of our youngsters for making some noise and called them out by name. And everybody, a lot of people quietly, lay it on. They can't be doing that. Well, they couldn't be doing that, shouldn't have been doing it. But It was easy for him to head on the first train out of town because he had to get back to his responsibilities. But for some of the family members, they were still broken up. And it took me, I'm not saying this is right or wrong, but I spent 3 hours consoling some of the relatives. It's all right. It's going to be okay. There will be a tomorrow. Sometimes a person has to be a diplomat to step in at the right time and the right way, or try to, in order to hold things together, in order to not lose anybody in the process. It's easy to make sweeping statements. We have to weigh our words and the impact of them. Sometimes we don't always know all the facts, and we still have to maybe make a decision. That will be things that you'll be faced with. And with God's help, you'll be successful. In Hebrews 13 is an important scripture that will may have not meant much to you now, but will make a whole lot of sense and resonate with you one day in the future. Hebrews 13, verse 17. It says, obey them, Hebrews 13, verse 17. Obey them that have the rule over you, and submit yourselves, for they, now this will be describing you in the future, they watch for your souls, as they that must give account, and that they can do it with joy and not with grief. You'll be entrusted with the care of hundreds, if not thousands, of people, and perhaps have assistance, because there'll be the need, if you're inheriting the responsibility of cities, how many congregations can you have in any city? A lot of them. It'll be important that you'll know what's going on. Not to be a spy, not to be nosy, but to just be aware of how are the brethren doing. And you'll watch for those souls. There can't be a time when God says to you, well, how are your people doing? You say, beats me. I don't know. I missed the last three activities. I couldn't tell you. That's not going to go. So to the whatever extent you can, either you or those that you appoint, that you'll be working with, will want to know how the brethren are doing. That's just typical. Paul talked about that back in the book of Acts. He'd come and he'd say, it's time to get back and do another tour through Europe, you know, and let's see how they do. Yeah, that'll be on your minds. Your business will be your family, and your family will be your business. And your family will be the brethren that you love. And it'll be a lot of work, but a lot of enthusiastic joy to see that happening. A point to illustrate here is that you start with people where they are, not where you necessarily hope they might be. You might think, oh, I wish I had a spiritual giant over in this region of my city to really shore things up and to get some activities going and help the people more. You start with people where they are. There was this time, one time when a historian came into a small town and he asked a longtime resident, he says, quote, were there any great men born in this town? The man looked at him and says, nope, only babies. It would be easy to look at somebody who isn't, quote, the whole package and just write them off. People do that to each other. Most of the world wanted to write off Winston Churchill. It would have been tragic if they did. To quote one of his closest confidants, this man said, quote, when you meet Sir Winston, you immediately discover that this man is obnoxious, he's belligerent, and he's an egotistical freak of nature. And then you spend the rest of your life discovering all of his virtues. And at the right moment, at the right time, based on his prior experiences, some good, some not, he became the right person to save England, at least to lead it through a very dark age during World War II. Well, people develop over time. They don't become gold and silver overnight. But they may come to you as combustible stubble, and you transform them, guide them, work with them, help them, and teach them, and get them to the point where they have transformed into the gold and the silver. People are precious, and a lot of people are very astute. They may not be able to articulate their thoughts exactly, but they can tell. Who cares? They can tell a lot of times who knows or who is, quote, the real deal. Kind of like one time this antique collector. He knew the value of antiques. He went to this one old junk collector. He walked into his barn and he could hardly walk through the aisles. It was just junk and clutter all over the place. It was dusty and dingy. And he looked and saw that pretty much everything was worthless until he stared at this unusual old ceramic bowl. And this cat was licking milk out of it. And he knew which dynasty that belonged to in China. He knew approximately the price, and he knew it was quite valuable. And he thought, well, I got to pull one over on this guy. I can't let him know that I know how valuable that is. And so he kept looking at it, and the cat was drinking. He said, well, there's nothing here I need. He told the ant junk collector, I'll tell you what, I'll buy that cat from you. And the idea was, well, if you get the cat, you get the dish. Yeah, he says, no, don't buy the cat. That's silly. No, I'll give you $100 for that cat. Really? Okay, he's yours. And then as he's got the cat and he's not really happy with it and didn't want the cat to claw him, he says, I tell you what, I need a dish for that cat. I'll give you $10 for that little dish on the floor. And the guy said, no, I can't do that. I hear that's worth the money. In fact, some people say it came from China. He said, business has been kind of slow lately, but I'm pretty happy to say that I've sold 17 cats. So sometimes people can see through a ruse. They can see through insincerity. Brethren want the real deal. And there's no reason why you can't be the real deal. As one famous person, philosopher, said, quote, if God is your partner, make your plans big. Rather than just handle the responsibility, I think you and I would want to make the most of it. To illustrate that, and this is to underscore the fact that not everybody is the same. Not everybody wants to get an A+ in things. Some people be happy with a B or a C+. Not everybody gets the same reward. You're not going to give out the same reward to all of your people over the time that you are working with them. There was a man once that had three sons that worked at a shipyard. One son made $20,000, the other made $40,000 a year, and the third made $100,000 a year. The dad thought that was not fair. He wondered, and he visited the boss, and he says, why the inequity? How come it's such a discrepant difference? The boss said, if you've got a few hours, I'll show you. So just sit here right there next to my desk, and I'll make the following phone call. So he called, the call went out to the three sons and some other people, and he said, a particular ship, the Constellation, has arrived in port. Go examine the 2,500 fur coats that it has delivered, and see if we should go ahead and have the company purchase them. That was it. The ship arrived. Go examine the merchandise. See if we should go ahead and purchase them. And the number first son called back. And he said, I've made a phone call down there, and it sounds like the fur coats are good and that they should be purchased. The second son called the boss, but later. He says, I went down to the boat and inspected the fur coats, and I think the company should buy them. The third son said, but it took him over an hour to get his response in. He says, boss, these 2,500 fur coats are in excellent condition. I told the merchants with the ship that you will meet him to sign the order. I also noticed many mink coats as well. I called the chain store and said that we probably could supply quite a few of those. And they would pay us $400 per coat, and I can get that off the ship at $200 each. We will probably make $30,000 for the company. I also saw 1,000 dresses that we can sell at a 30% profit. Already have investigated where we have a buyer for that, so I tentatively arranged a contract for us to do it that awaits your approval and signature. After that, the father, the three sons said, "Wow, the first son didn't do what you asked. The second one only did what he was asked. And the third son did way more than he was asked. I see the difference now. Thank you very much." People respond differently. Everybody will not be the same. Your job will be to encourage everybody under your care equally and inspire their forward progress. And when they make forward progress, you can share in their joy. And you will have to work sometimes differently from one from another, because everybody isn't the same or responds in the same way. Now, leads me to a final thing. There is a final exam for all this work. It isn't as just we go floating along merrily, because God is interested in quality growth, and he knows that sometimes it takes pressure to produce, and sometimes deadlines to produce. Realize that after the thousand-year millennium, God will allow Satan, who has been bound up, to be loosed again. And then the question will be, when he tries to deceive people and try to have one last gasp at influencing this world, and he only does what God allows, but God will allow him to be free, that will be the time to find out how good of a job you or I did with our people, because they will be exposed to the one that actually deceived one-third of the angels, and he will be free to influence anybody that will allow him to influence them. That means the brethren of your congregations and cities will be exposed to the master deceiver, the one that deceived the whole world by definition in Revelation 12:9. In Revelation 20, will be a final scripture here. Revelation chapter 20, and verse 7. "And when the 1,000 years are expired, Satan will be loosed out of his prison, and he shall go out to deceive the nations which are in the four quarters of the earth, Gog and Magog, and gather them together to battle, the number of whom is the sand of the sea." And so he will have a lot of influence. He will be able to deceive people. They should have seen 1,000 years of peace in the millennium and said, "This could not, nothing can beat this." But yet some people will not, they'll allow themselves to be deceived. And so they went up to the breadth of the earth and compassed the camp of the saints round about the beloved city. And well, God will deal with them. And fire comes down from God out of heaven and he devours them. And then the devil that was deceived is cast into the lake of fire. I think an analogy to that would be, if you know history from Europe, when Napoleon was the emperor, he was wreaking havoc over Europe for a number of years. Then he was placed in exile, but he escaped. And then for several months he wreaked havoc in Europe before he was finally captured at the Battle of Waterloo. And in a sense, Satan is let loose, it says, for a little season, and then he's put away. But in that time, he creates enough havoc that deceives people, and it shows how well we've done. In the history of God's church, whether we're talking 20 years ago or 1,000 years ago or whatever, there have been times of trial that has revealed the strength and conviction of brethren. It's adversity that reveals character, not prosperity. And so God will allow some of that, just as he allows adversity in our day to day in many different ways. In conclusion, we will have congregations that will be caring for many, many people. It will be important that we are patient. We realize that all of the people that we deal with are not going to be perfect people. They'll make great moves at times and then make silly mistakes at times, but we have unconditional concern. That doesn't change. Secondly, we have an additional reason to endure to the end. That is to help others. It's not just enough to get to the finish line when Christ returns. Once we catch our breath, we'll be involved with other people. It will be a wonderful experience. It'll be the most important work that one could ever do. And then, again, we need to understand the nature of the ministry that is people-oriented. And that they're not an interruption of our lives. They are the reason that we are where we are. So it is an important calling, and it's one that has continual stepping stones into eternity. It's one of the reasons God called us and why He called us now, that we can get ready to help others later. It presumes that we stay loyal to what is right and that we know how to be positive instead of negative in our patient guidance and direction with other brethren. So let's be glad that we have that opportunity. I read a job description that may be facetious in one sense. Nobody could fulfill everything that I had just read, to be young and old at the same time and do everything. But as a spirit being, we'll have more energy, and we will want to be as involved as possible and relate to as many people as possible, because their futures will depend on their relationship with us. We want to give them the best foundation we can. Hence, the title of the sermon, "This is Your Greatest Responsibility Yet."